Football Weekly is on the air.
Hi, everybody. I'm Hub Arkush. Wayne Larrabee out on assignment this week, but Eric Edholm joins me as we once again bring you Pro Football Weekly on the radio, where we try every week to bring you all the news, scoops, and rumors from around the NFL, some before they've even happened.
A busy week for the Patriots. Richard Sherman mouths off, and we dig into the trenches in the NFL draft.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
Hi, and welcome to Pro Football Weekly on the radio. I am Hub Arkush, the publisher and editor here. Our regular host, Wayne Larrabee, is out on assignment this week, but hopes to be back with us next week as we continue building towards the NFL college draft, as well as keeping up to date with the remaining moves in veteran free agency. I am joined in studio by our senior editor, Eric Edholm, and on the Pro Football Weekly Hotline's associate editor, Arthur Arkush. And, guys, a very busy week this week for the New England Patriots. First, they got some relatively good news. When a guy gets sentenced to 30 days in the slammer, I guess it's not good news, but a lot of concern about what might happen to last year's rookie cornerback, starting rookie cornerback, Alphonso Dinard. He had some trouble at Nebraska, which is why the Patriots were able to steal him late in the draft, and I guess it worked out relatively well. He is going to get 30 days in jail, but it will not miss any time. He should not miss any training camp. He will put the incident behind him. And I think it's worth noting, Eric, as we discuss this, that everybody I talked to around Lincoln, a lot of college scouts, people who knew him, said that Dinard's not a bad kid. That when he got in this trouble, he got in a physical altercation, it came as a complete surprise to a lot of people. And so it's unfortunate that he's going to have this time in jail, but I think you have to spin this one as positive, as it's a chance to finally put it all behind him and won't impact what is a pretty impressive start to an NFL career.
Yeah, the timing couldn't have been worse for him. I think it was off the top of my head like 5 days before the draft. So that certainly affected his status, shot him down to the seventh round. Patriots were able to steal him, and they had to thrust him right into the lineup. Guys like Rozai Dowling didn't play up to the standards he was expected to as a high second round pick, and Denner jumps in, plays well, but I still think cornerback's a huge need for him. I still think that with their limited allotment of draft picks, they could go that direction pretty high in the draft.
And Arthur, the Patriots continue to tinker at wide receiver, and I think tinker is the only word you can really use. It's a bit of a puzzle. Obviously, the passing game is built around the two tight ends and Rob Gronkowski and Aaron Hernandez, and we'll talk about Gronk in just a moment, but they've allowed Wes Welker to move on. Doesn't look like Brandon Lloyd's going to be back, but they have now re-signed Julian Edelman, who, of course, was injured late last year, and they have given an offer sheet, a surprisingly low 1-year tender offer for $2.5 million to Emmanuel Sanders of the Pittsburgh Steelers. And as we tape late in the week, the Steelers have a couple days left to decide whether they're going to match the offer or take the third round draft choice in compensation. And I'm hearing that a lot of people are speculating that the Steelers are going to let Sanders move and take the pick.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting move. I think this is in line with a lot of what the Patriots like to do. They take some guys who've, you know, had some success. Sanders still a young kid, but he is a veteran. So this is a Belichick move. He's going to try and sort of catch lightning in a bottle. Sanders has a immense talent, but has been banged up during his time in Pittsburgh. So let's see if they can finally fill that outside the numbers spot they've been looking to for so long. As far as Julian Edelman, I think we all know versatility is the key here. And beyond that, I think it's just a really good insurance policy. You obviously swapped out Wes Welker for Danny Amendola, the oft-injured Danny Amendola. So I think having Julian Edelman certainly gives the Patriots some flexibility. He's been pretty productive himself when he's been able to stay on the field.
Yeah, and Eric, I was going to add, of course, Danny Amendola signed in free agency, as was Donald Jones from Buffalo.
Yep.
But it's an interesting complete remake or makeover of the wide receiver core, and it shows you the kind of incredible confidence they have in Tom Brady, you know, for obvious reasons. But then you got to add the latest news on Rob Gronkowski, and that there is a nagging infection in that forearm. There was a plate inserted. Looks like there will be more surgery. It looks like he may not be ready for the start of training camp, and that has to have an impact on all these maneuvers at wide receiver.
Yeah, an additional procedure on that forearm, which he suffered on an extra point late in a blowout game. Everyone kind of questioned Belichick. Obviously, it was kind of a fluky thing, but you know, the infection reportedly requires 10 weeks healing time. So if he has that in the next couple weeks, we're already kind of pushing the start of camp and questioning whether he's going to be ready for that. The people I've talked to seem to think it's I don't want to say much ado about nothing, but that he should be back in the fold. So obviously, like you said, it's a tight end heavy offense. That's where the stars are going to be. But it wouldn't stun me if they get Sanders to get some production elsewhere as well.
A couple of big name veterans making visits late this week. There are a number of teams in the Antoine Winfield Derby, a little unusual for a 36, 37-year-old cornerback, but it looked late in the week like the Seattle Seahawks would be the winner on that one. Arthur appears to be a pretty obvious fit. They have arguably the best starting four in the NFL. Winfield could step right in as the nickel in a somewhat reduced role, save a little wear and tear on that aging body, and be a difference maker. You know, probably not a team with a need in that area, but it just shows you how the Seahawks are throwing everything out there, that they are absolutely committing to making a run for the Super Bowl this year.
Yeah, no question. I mean, especially when you take into consideration their rookie last year, Jeremy Lane, actually played quite well when they were dealing with the suspensions to Brandon Browner. But it does, you know, just speak volumes about the fact they're trying to win now. I'm not totally surprised. Obviously, 36, 37, you know, is getting up there in years. But Winfield has shown he can still be productive. Obviously, you know, one of the better run supporters at the cornerback position in the NFL. So not shocked to see there are some interested teams. And if it does turn out to be Seattle, gosh, they just continue to get some major bargain bin deals this offseason.
Yeah, we'll get back to Seahawk cornerbacks and suspensions in a few minutes. But for right now, I also want to talk about James Harrison, the former defensive MVP of the NFL. Eric, visiting with the Cincinnati Bengals, that's a bit of a puzzle to me and doesn't seem like a good fit, but it's obvious that Harrison is not in tremendous demand and is looking for work where he can find it.
Yeah, I mean, the Bengals obviously have the salary cap space, and, you know, they'd love to sign former Steelers and be more of a presence in the NFC, or AFC North, rather. And I think for Harrison, he's wanting to stay in the division and say, I'm going to try to stick it to the Steelers as best they can. Word coming out that they didn't even want him back at the veterans minimum, that there was no real discussion about bringing him back, that they were going to let him go no matter what. So he's 35. He's injury prone now at this point in his career. Does he have the explosiveness? I don't know. And I just don't know if he's a fit in that defense, a 4-3 scheme. He hasn't played it in the NFL.
All right, guys, we're going to take a very quick commercial break here. We mentioned those Seattle cornerbacks. Richard Sherman's got his foot, his foreleg and thigh down his mother. We're going to talk about his doings this week in just a moment. You've got Pro Football Weekly on your radio dial. We appreciate your listening in. I'm Hub Arkish. Wayne Larrabee, who is our host each week, is out this week, but should be back next week as we really dig deeper into NFL pre-draft goings-ons. I am joined by senior editor Eric Edholm and associate editor Arthur Arkish. And guys, we mentioned the Seattle Seahawks and cornerbacks. Richard Sherman is arguably, if not the most, certainly one of the three or four most talented cornerbacks in the NFL. I don't think anybody disputes that. Unfortunately, he's one of these guys who can't seem to stay out of his own way. As a matter of fact, if you go back and hear the story at Stanford, went in as a wide receiver and ran his mouth so often and so much beyond the fact he wasn't being productive enough that the offensive coaches finally said, get him out of here. And that's how he became a cornerback. Defensive coaches weren't all that thrilled with him either. And that's why he slipped in the draft and the Seahawks stole him. And now he has become one of the top corners in the league. Of course, last year he had the very high profile failed drug test believed to be for Adderall. He beat it on a procedural claim. And now, earlier this week, Eric, he is quoted as saying, hey, I don't get it. Half the league is on Adderall anyway. And the league office did not appreciate it. Now,
No. They
fired back in a big way. Sherman has since recanted it, claimed he was misquoted in the story in the Vancouver Sun, I believe it was. But this is a guy who's got to figure out that there's a time to kind of, if not shut your mouth, at least stop talking quite as much.
I mean, he's a fun guy. You know, he obviously has a zest for life, whatever you want to call it. I mean, he's had some interesting things to say in the past. And I do believe the NFL needs many more characters. You know, the personality of the league has kind of dissipated in recent years. But this guy takes it beyond at certain points. And obviously, like you said, the league was sort of in defiant opposition of what Sherman said. They said the comments are ill-informed and inaccurate and talked about the testing procedures for Adderall and such. So, you know, like you said, Sherman got out of it maybe on a procedural thing, maybe on something that hid the fact that he actually did do these things. So we'll see. I mean, I think he's kind of backed down since and kind of said that this isn't really true.
Well, and it does raise another interesting issue, Arthur, which is that there are a number of players in the NFL, I'm not saying it's a large number, certainly not half or the majority, but there are athletes in every sport who suffer from ADHS, for which Adderall is the prescription of choice, and with the prescription, they have to take it and are okay taking it. And so you wonder, you know, how can you have a drug that is categorized as a performance enhancer and yet some guys can use it and some guys can't just because they have a medical prescription? It is a bit of a problem for the league.
it's a bit of a gray area. And even beyond that, ADHD and some of these other, disorders that you can get prescribed Adderall for, according to some people, are some of the most misdiagnosed, overdiagnosed sicknesses you can have. So it does kind of just sort of add to that dilemma and kind of add to what the NFL has on its hands. There's no question. We heard a lot about Adderall and it becoming an increasing problem in the league last year. You know that it's a stimulant. It gets these guys going on the field. So it's something they're going to have to keep a close eye on for sure, because I don't think it's going to be going away.
Let's talk about the cornerback that Richard Sherman, I don't want to say would like to be, but I think the one guy everybody pretty much still agrees is a notch ahead of him. That, of course, is Darrelle Revis. In New York, for now, Jets have made no secret about their desire to trade him. It seems like the Jets and the Bucks have been dating forever. They've been talking about this for weeks, and it seems like the Bucks are willing to give up a first-round pick. The question is this year or next. And, Eric, what we're hearing is that this deal is no closer to being done today than it was when they first started discussing it a month ago, and yet both sides would still like to make it happen.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the Bucks at this point are willing to give up their first-round pick. And I got to question their strategy, because all they needed to do is kind of step back and look at the league. And there's not, like you said, a long line of teams looking to trade for this guy because of the salary demands coming off an injury, concerns about sort of the way he's handled business up in New York the last couple of years, his little entourage that goes with him. I mean, he's a great corner. When healthy, he is probably the best. So, all that comes with him, and yet the Bucks seem to be the only team in the market for him. And if they'd held firm with a lower price than a first-round pick, they may have gotten it. The Jets may have panicked. I think everybody up there is saying, what are the Jets doing? What is their direction? What's their future? So, I don't know. I still think this gets done at some point before draft day on Thursday in a couple weeks. Probably going to involve that number 13 pick. If I'm the Bucks, I stand firm on that. I don't give up anything else.
Well, and the reason the Jets are trying so hard to make the deal, it's not like he's not a great player. He is coming off ACL surgery, so you don't know if you're getting the same Darrelle Revis. But beyond that, he's a free agent again next year, and they know they're not going to be able to pay him. And you wonder, looking at the Bucks with the Kings ransom they spent in free agency last year, not this year, how does their cap allow for something like this? And that may be part of it, too, because it's not just trading for Revis. It's being able to sign him long-term once you make that commitment. Arthur, I want to talk a little bit about the Jacksonville Jaguars, who are one of the teams on your beat. The new GM, David Caldwell, did an interview in Jacksonville the other day where he said he wanted to make clear that they were totally happy staying at number two, that he suspected that might be what would happen. He didn't say they wouldn't consider trading the pick. He said he just doesn't see it developing, and that they've identified a player who they're comfortable is going to be there, who they'd love to have as a cornerstone of the franchise. And I'm hearing the same things out of Kansas City. Obviously, the problem in this draft, without the quarterback that you trade up to get in the first three, four, five picks, it's just not likely that these picks are going to move the way they have in past years.
And even beyond the quarterback, I just think a lot of what you're hearing about this draft is that maybe 11 through 20 may turn out to be just as good in the long run as 1 through 10. There's not a lot of surefire guys, so I kind of have to laugh when I hear Dave Caldwell, when I hear John Dorsey saying these things. Well, of course they're saying these things. They don't know if there's any trade partners that are willing to come up anyway, so they're kind of, in that position, at least for the time being. But not to say there's not some good players and some guys who can help. I do think in the Jaguars' case, they've been looking for that pass rusher for years and years. The name you've been hearing lately is Deion Jordan. Would that make sense at number two? Perhaps. But, I think both of these guys, while they may be saying right now that they're comfortable where they're at, if it does turn out that, a quarterback needy team does want to move up, if there are other guys that other teams have their eyes on, I still wouldn't be stunned at all to see either the Chiefs or the Jaguars end up moving down.
All right, guys, another quick commercial break here. Next segment, there's some awfully good veteran free agents out there still. Problems are a little old. We'll talk about them in a moment. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Pro Football Weekly on the radio, and we want to talk this segment about some real talent that is still available in free agency. We don't know of a lot of teams that have broken the bank, so to speak, other than maybe the Miami Dolphins. You would think there'd be some money left to sign these guys, and yet for some reason, they are still available. Now, there is one common thread in most of them. They tend to be in their early to mid-30s. A couple others, maybe guys who've had, I don't want to say character issues so much as, questions about their behavior in the past. But, Arthur, we'll start on the offensive line, where I can't for the life of me understand how Andre Smith of the Cincinnati Bengals, A, hasn't been re-signed by the Bengals, considering the ton of cap space they still have left, but B, more importantly, as much of a mauler in the running game as he's become, why aren't other teams in this derby? And then you add Bryant McKinney, who's been off troubled, but certainly was a key part of that Ravens Super Bowl offensive line, and New York Jets offensive guard Brandon Moore. He's up there in the early 30s, but a pretty good player. These guys are all still out there and available.
Yeah, they are. And the latter two are a little bit older. In the case of Andre Smith, I can't help but to think the teams are just worried they're going to give him that big deal and he's going to eat himself right out of the league. That was obviously a concern coming out of college, and he did get off to the slow start before having the breakout year in a contract season last year. So I get back to wondering if maybe the Bengals tagged the wrong guy. You could have given this, you know, Andre Smith one more year to prove once again that he's ready for that big deal and then have another year to work it all out. But obviously they didn't go in that direction. When you talk about Bryant McKinney, I think he's in the, you know, early 30s now. He has shown some versatility. He was a huge unsung guy in the Ravens Super Bowl run last year, but he is getting up there in years, much like Brandon Moore. You have to think that's at the front of the list as to why these guys are still out there.
Eric, two players who are not going to be the focal point of anybody's offense, but who can be big contributors, and one of them not even that old, a kid you know pretty well, running back Ahmad Bradshaw with the New York Giants. Now, granted, the chronic foot injuries, I know there's a concern about that, but he's too good a football player to still be on the street when you realize the couple teams out there who desperately need help at the position.
Yeah, he's the kind of kid who I think, just if you go back and roll back the tape from last year and watch the way he competes and runs so hard. I mean, maybe he can't be that 250-carry guy, but Pittsburgh's met with him. I wouldn't be stunned that if they don't pick up the right back in the first three, four rounds of the draft, they sign him the day after the draft, that kind of situation. So, you know, I was on the plane back from the Super Bowl with him. He was obviously in a lot of pain still working through that injury. Guessing he won't be fully healthy till June or July. That's what NFL teams probably have discovered.
Josh Cribbs is up there. There's no question about that. But these kick-returning specialists who give you a little bit at wide receiver sometimes have second wins in their careers and become, you know, just as dominant in their early 30s as they were when they first started. I can't imagine he'd be that expensive. You wonder why he's still on the street.
I mean, yeah, I think there are a lot of guys out there who fit that mold. And, I mean, between the returners, the special teams guys, and the defensive linemen, those are the positions that I would focus on. I mean, 3 years ago, if you had a lineup of Dwight Freeney, John Abraham, Cedric Ellison, and Richard Seymour, you'd probably win the Super Bowl. Those four guys would have gotten you there, but obviously age and injuries and salary demands are kind of pushing those positions down the ladder a little bit, I should say.
Well, and Arthur, I was going to take that in a slightly different direction from America. I think that there will be folks who say the three words Hall of Fame at some point about Dwight Freeney, Richard Seymour, and John Abraham. I don't know if they're Hall of Famers or not. And none of them have had serious injuries. I mean, Freeney, I guess, really struggled, you know, last year with some leg injuries. Abraham was in and out of the lineup a little bit with nagging injuries. Richard Seymour has been pretty healthy. Cedric Ellis, a very productive, you know, couple years in the Pro Bowl. You throw in Izzy Adonijay of the Bears and Lawrence Jackson of the Lions. These guys are, and now they all have one thing in common. They're all right around 30 to 33 years old, but all have been productive right up until towards the end of this season.
Yeah, let's throw in one surefire Hall of Famer whose name you didn't mention, obviously Charles Woodson, who said earlier this week that, you know, he's viewed as ancient by teams, and clearly by the lack of interest, that's accurate. But just one other high-profile name. You know, as far as Dwight Freeney, the guy I watch the closest, I still do think that he can definitely help a team. I think with a lot of these older guys, it's all about the situation. You need to get them in, you know, the right circumstances where they're going to be able to maximize what they still do have left in the tank, and then obviously a team that's trying to fill particular needs, whether of course it's a pass rusher with a guy like Dwight Freeney or maybe a leader of, you know, a vocal guy in the secondary with the Charles Woodson. So it definitely depends on the circumstances, but a lot of these guys I think are still going to get picked up eventually when that sort of second wave or even third wave post-draft free agency that Eric just hit on occurs, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Well, and Woodson, the oldest of all these guys, 37 right. years yep. old. Now, he has stayed relatively healthy, but he did miss 7 weeks last year. And then you throw in Mike Jenkins. Maybe it's a chronic shoulder situation. I don't know. That's the only explanation I can think, Eric, for why somebody wouldn't want to, you know, bring him in. And then Quentin Jammer out of San Diego has probably lost a quarter of a step. These are guys who can still play.
Yeah, I believe Jenkins just got a deal from the Raiders, so I think he's okay. signed up there. But, yeah, I mean, the same thing. There were concerns. Pro Bowler back in 2009, you'd think he would have gotten a deal sooner. And then Jammer, a guy who started, 11 seasons or something like that. I mean, he's been in the lineup a lot over the years, and maybe not special, maybe not the top 10 pick we thought he was coming out, but a serviceable guy nonetheless.
Well, and you know, guys, you mentioned a surefire lockdown first ballot Hall of Famer. There's no bigger name on this list than Brian Urlacher.
Yeah.
And then you plug in Sean Phillips of the Chargers. Daryl Smith's been around a little bit, but very productive.
Carlos Dansby,
Nick Barnett.
Yeah.
These are all guys who can still play. Now, some of them, you know, there's some ego involved. Urlacher, you know, it's funny, you talk about James Harrison and the Steelers. It was clear the Bears didn't want Urlacher at any price either. He had agreed to take a greatly reduced deal. You still wonder, though, why isn't it happening somewhere else? Questions about the knee. And then Arthur, I mean, to me, you know, the Packers defense hasn't been the same since they let Nick Barnett get away 3 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. I would tend to agree with you. And, you know, that's probably for a separate segment, but we could talk about what the Packers still need to do to get back defensively to, you know, where they were a couple years ago. So, yeah, you know, it is a little puzzling. And, we're just, again, I have to wait and see how it all plays out. I do think that after some of the teams get a chance to get some of the young guys in the draft, then they can see what needs they still have left. That's when you'll see some of these names start to come off the list.
All right, guys, it is draft time. We will continue our position by position breakdown. Next segment, we're going to take a look not only at the top tight ends in this draft, but some guys who might go in the middle and late rounds as well. We are, and we are moving now from veteran free agency in the NFL to the 2013 NFL College Draft. Last week, we went position by position for you with the quarterbacks, running backs, and wide receivers. So we will continue breaking them down by position this week and next week with our pre-draft information. And we start with tight ends right now, guys. And pretty good year for tight ends in the draft, not just right at the top where there are three who could conceivably go in the first round or at least the first 45 or 50 picks, but then there are as many as seven that we have, you know, top three, top two, two and a half, top three rounds on. It starts with what has been the big two in many people's eyes, Tyler Eifert out of Notre Dame and Zach Ertz out of Stanford. But on our draft board at Pro Football Weekly, Gavin Escobar out of San Diego State has actually moved ahead of Zach Ertz and could go in the bottom of the first round. I think, Eric, the one place where you do get some consensus, though, is that Tyler Eifert will probably be the first tight end off the board.
Yeah, I saw him at his pro day. I thought he looked really good. I only did the positional drills, didn't, you know, stood on his combine numbers. And this is probably the one true sort of chess piece, you know, in terms of the passing game, moving him around, putting him in motion, using him as an inline blocker, flexing him out, doing different things. I think whoever gets him will be pretty creative with him. And, you know, my best guess is he'll probably go in the first 25 or 30 picks. His ceiling is probably somewhere around 15 to 18. I don't think he gets past the Packers, just knowing that Ted Thompson is the, you know, best player available kind of guy. So I think at 26 is where the latest he would go off the board. And, you know, special guy, tall wingspan. I mean, you know, all the things you want in a tight end. Maybe not a great blocker yet at this time.
Well, and then we look at the other kid, Zach Ertz. You know, Arthur, as Eric just mentioned, there are still some questions about Eifert's ability to be an inline blocker. Ertz is even a bigger kid than Eifert, but again, primarily a receiver, and you wonder if Stanford is now beginning to develop a reputation for producing these tight ends as you look at what they've sent out the last few years.
Yeah, that's right, and you know, I think with Ertz, another guy who is certainly very intriguing is going to be able to help a team. I'm not sure he has the off-the-charts athleticism for a guy like Eifert who's got that same similar size, but you're right, the Stanford guys are definitely starting to make a name for themselves, and it's interesting because after last year where, of course, we saw one go at the top and then, you know, Ryan Grigson come right back with Dwayne Allen, that was a class that didn't have a lot of tight end talent. You had to get them up at the top, so there do seem to be a few more options here, and some teams are going to be able to help themselves, it would appear.
Now, the guy who's really been a mover ever since the combine, maybe it's because it was San Diego State and not as visible during the season as Ertz and Eifert, is Gavin Escobar out of San Diego State, almost 6'6", 6'5 and 7'8", 255 pounds. Only a 4.84 guy in the 40, which is great for a guy that size. It's not unusual at the position, but he's an outstanding athlete who is a very good receiver, Eric, another one of these kids who is going to, you know, have to learn to be a better blocker.
Right, and I don't think he's blazing, but he has shown some ability to get down the seam and I think could be an interesting playmaker. This kid, Travis Kelce out of Cincinnati, is really interesting, too. Finally got to work out and show scouts. He's healthy after the end of the season. He had a number of big plays in college, flash plays, brother of Jason Kelce for the center for the Eagles. So, like you said, up and down, there's some good talent. There's another Stanford kid, you know, this Levine Toilolo, I think I said it right. But
Toilolo.
Toilolo, yes. But no, a massive kid, you know, with a frame that makes you think he, too, could be a great inline guy.
Arthur, Levine Toilolo is 6'8 and 1/8, 260 pounds. and ran the same 40 as
Escobar.
What do
these kids eat? You know?
I don't know. And this is why I say, if you know, first Jim Harbaugh and then David Shaw, obviously it's become a priority at Stanford. But you mentioned Travis Kelce. You've got Chris Gregg out of Arkansas. And then, Arthur, there's the H-back type. And a kid that fascinates me is Jordan Reed out of Florida. I don't know that he'll ever be a complete tight end, but he's going to play in the NFL. And for a team that wants to run that pure West Coast, he's a kid you want to keep an eye on as well.
Yeah, he's definitely got some unique size, skill, speed, you know, ratios for sure. And, you know, Eric talked at the top a little bit about the chess pieces. That's kind of where you associate some of these H-backs, guys who you can line up all over the formation, and they can help teams in a variety of ways. You're seeing that, you know, clubs are looking for him more and more because they just give defenses one more thing to stress about. So, yeah, he's another intriguing kid for sure, this Jordan Reed.
Well, and a few more players to keep an eye on. We mentioned the depth at the position. Those seven, really, Eifert, Escobar, Ertz, Toilolo, Gregg, Kelce, Reed, sitting on the Pro Football Weekly draft board in that order, are probably all Thursday, Friday-type picks, first three rounds. But then you go a little deeper, Ryan Otten out of San Jose State, Deion Sims at Michigan State, Vance McDonald from Rice, Matt Furstenberg from Maryland, Nick Cassa from Colorado. We've got draftable grades on all of these kids, and Deion Sims is a kid I watched in Lansing quite a bit. Pretty good receiver, pretty good blocker, so a very good year for tight ends in this upcoming draft. It's an outstanding year on the offensive line. We're going to talk about that next after we take this very quick commercial break. We're back with more Pro Football Weekly's 2013 NFL College Draft Preview. We're going position by position. Just took a look at tight ends, and now we will move to the offensive line. Let's start with the centers first, guys. And this is, you know, traditionally not a very draftable position, and yet you've got three kids here. One, Travis Frederick out of Wisconsin is clearly the best. I don't think he gets into the first round, but I don't see him slipping out of the second round. And then you look at Brian Schwenke from California, and, of course, Barrett Jones off that Alabama line, Eric. Most likely these are third-round picks. Barrett Jones had played some tackle. Now they're projecting him as a center. Going to be lots of Alabama offensive linemen in this draft.
Extremely smart kid, too, Barrett Jones, but I think the limited athleticism is probably what moves him down a little bit. I like Frederick a lot, you know, blue-collar guy. Wisconsin has produced a ton of interior linemen over the last couple of years. First rounder in Zietler last year. So, yeah, I think it's a decent class of centers. Like you said, we don't see a lot of them, but those top three are clearly ahead above the class.
Well, and Arthur, one of the, you know, you talk about, I don't want to call them surprises, but unique differences in various drafts as you look at them. Rarely do you see offensive guards drafted highly. Occasionally they're late in the first round, then they start to go middle of second, third round. David DeCastro went 23rd to the Steelers last year. A lot of people thought he should have gone higher than that and didn't because he was an offensive guard. But in this draft, you look at Chance Warmack, another kid off the Alabama line, and some people think Jonathan Cooper out of North Carolina is even a better player, certainly as good. These are two kids with top 10 grades. Now, whether they go in the top 10 picks is another story or not, but both Warmack from Alabama and Cooper from North Carolina, I've heard scouts say future Hall of Famers if they stay healthy.
Just incredible talents, and actually different types of talents. You know, Warmack is a guy who wants to win with power and just kind of run over people and manhandle in the running game, and of course Cooper is more an athletic fit. He, you know, was an undersized guy who's going to probably appeal more to a move type, you know, zone blocking team. But these are legit talents and kids that are really going to be able to help right away, plug and play starters. And it is fascinating because you say it's so rare to see guys go this high, that is interior offensive linemen. But it's also so rare to see, as you said, two guys grade out this highly. They're gonna be off the board before we know it.
And one note on Cooper too. He only played one game in college at center, and by his own admission, didn't go very well. But that was a late fill in because of an injury. But there are NFL teams out there who think that Cooper could end up being a better center. He might could play at 290, 295. He doesn't have to bulk up past his ideal weight. So that could be an interesting position for him, one that he hasn't played a lot at, but could figure better to in the pros.
Well, one other kid we should mention, Brian Winters.
Love
out
him.
Of Kent State.
Absolutely.
We've got him graded as a potential bottom of the first round. He's more likely middle to late second round. Maybe because of Kent State, he slips to the third. But at 6'3 and 5'8", 320, he played some left tackle in college. He's projecting as a guard on the right side. But in any other draft, he'd be the first guard off the board.
I think so, too. And you know, that conference has produced a lot of good talent, especially in the offensive line. He's a blue-collar guy, kind of reminds me of Logan Mankins. You know, I mean, Mankins was kind of seen as that, you know, sort of low second round pick, you know, a high floor, low ceiling prospect. But, you know, Winters has the same sort of pedigree as Mankins. It wouldn't stun me if he goes somewhere in the 30s or 40s.
Guys, there will be at least 9, possibly 11 offensive tackles drafted in the first 3 rounds. There will be at least 4 and possibly 6 drafted in the first round. But all of the focus right now is on the big 2, if we will. Luke Jokel or Jekyll. I constantly get Jokel. Well, and every time I say Jokel, somebody tells me it's Jekyll. Every time I say Jekyll, they say Jokel. I believe it's Luke Jokel. And then Eric Fisher out of Central Michigan. Now, you know, Jokel is clearly the highest graded of the group. Some of that because of the Texas A&M pedigree versus the Central Michigan pedigree for Eric Fisher. But don't forget, there's a few Chippewa offensive linemen who are playing pretty well in the NFL right now. And so, Arthur, I wouldn't sleep on Eric Fisher. These two kids are both going to be top 5 picks in this draft.
Yeah, they sure are. And you know what's kind of fascinating in a draft where we're talking about there's really no, you know, really great quarterbacks, surefire guys, really maybe not a lot of wide receivers that you think are going to be the next Julio Jones or A.J. Green, obviously. It's interesting and sort of ironic that there are these elite tackle prospects that are still going to have a chance to help out the passing games and the quarterbacks of teams in the NFL. But obviously, Jokel and Fisher up at the top. Another fascinating side note is a lot of people I respect quite a bit say that Jokel's teammate out at Texas A&M actually may turn out to be an even better prospect next year at left tackle.
Yeah, Jake Matthews, I agree. And I'll say this, you know, Joe Staley has obviously become a very solid left tackle in the pros. He's a Central Michigan kid. There are a handful of teams. There aren't top 10 teams, but there are teams who feel that Fisher is the better prospect, the more athletic prospect, and then he plays with an edge. He might actually be better than Jokel. You know, we look back 5 or 10 years from now.
All right, guys, Lane Johnson and DJ Fluker will be top 20 picks. There's no question about that. Kyle Long out of Oregon, if he doesn't go late in the first, is going to go high in the second. Then you look at Justin Pugh from Syracuse, Terran Armstead out of Arkansas, Pine Bluff, David Bakhtiari from Colorado, Menelik Watson from Florida State, a guy with about 16 games total experience.
Yeah, British kid.
You know, he could sneak into the first round, some people are saying. Definitely a second round. Add in Brennan Williams, Xavier Nixon, an outstanding group of offensive tackles, outstanding group of offensive linemen. Great year to have needs in that area in the NFL draft. We've got one more segment for you, and the defensive line may be more loaded than the offensive line. Welcome back, everybody. I am Hub Arkish, along with Eric Edholm and Arthur Arkish. Wayne Larrivee will be back with us next week, and we will be continuing our NFL pre-draft coverage and scouting reports in next week's show, as well as 2 weeks from today, where we will actually have coverage for you of the first round of the draft and be able to talk about the rest of it as it comes up over the weekend. Right now, we are looking at the defensive line, and I'll tell you guys, defensive end is okay. There's a couple really good prospects, but at defensive tackle, again, you've got as many as 6 or 7 players, not only in the first round, but possibly in the top 15 or top 20 picks. On the defensive end side, just 2 surefire first rounders. One is Bjorn Werner from Florida State, Eric. The other one is Ezekiel Ansah, or Ziggy, as he is known out of Brigham Young. And Ansah fascinates me because based on his production in college, he's a fourth round pick. But based on his physical attributes and being late to the game and what teams think they can do with him, he will be this year's version of Bruce Irvin last year with the Seattle Seahawks. He's a better football player than Irvin is.
Yeah, and different. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people have said Jason Pierre-Paul is another comparison. Obviously, the raw talent on the upside is sky high. And I think when it's all said and done, he's going to end up a top 10 pick. I don't know if we're talking number 3 overall. I don't know if we're talking number 9 to the Jets, something like that. He figures possibly as a 3-4 outside linebacker at the Marcus Ware type, at least as far as body and that goes, or Pierre-Paul, you know, with that kind of weak side 4-3 defensive end. Freakish athleticism, got to get his focus and his strength under control, got to get him with the right positional coach, but could be a special guy. I really like the interior guys better, but there's a couple interesting prospects at end.
Ansah is 6'5 1/4", 271. He runs a 4.6 40. He's got 35-inch arms. His hands are 10 1/4 inches. Yeah, I mean, he's an athlete you won't believe, but he's not a Mike Mamula combine-type defensive end. This is a guy who's been on the football field, and he has shown he can convert that to functional football ability. He just really needs coaching. Now, Werner is the safer pick, so to speak. He's been at the position forever. He's an outstanding NFL prospect, and he's going to be a top 20 pick. He's a junior coming out. But you know, you talk about high ceilings and high floors. I just think the ceiling on Ansa is as high as anybody in this draft. And then, Arthur, we get to the defensive tackles. And off the top, you guys are both Missouri alums. I forgot about that. So we'll let Arthur take a whack at
Unbiased.
Sheldon Richardson. Now, Sheldon Richardson, Sylvester Williams, Star Lotulelei, and Sharif Floyd could all be top 10 picks. That's how good they are. On most boards, when you got to sort them out, people, because of the ability, have Richardson on top, but there is some baggage that comes with it.
Yeah, that's right. These guys are, they're all just game wreckers. These are the types of players that can just absolutely, you know, turn an offensive game plan up on its side from the middle of the line. But when you talk about Sheldon Richardson, you mentioned he's a little bit of a different guy. He does not lack confidence. He is going to say what is on his mind pretty much all the time. There have been, some question marks with that regard, as far as his maturity is concerned. But as far as the athleticism goes, I mean, he's only a junior, so the arrow is pointing straight up. And like I said, this is a kid who is just going to be able to push the pocket, get after the quarterback, and really be a very versatile and complete football player.
Yeah, the size, speed, the triangle numbers on all these kids are through the roof. They're all incredibly athletic for big men. Most of them can play either in a three technique or an anchor tackle position. They're probably, you know, more 4-3 tackles than nose tackles. And Star Lotulelei, actually, some people thought was the number one overall pick, Eric, until the reports of his heart issues came out at the combine. Now he's been cleared. Everybody mm-hmm. said he's fine. And I think teams are believing that, but somehow he hasn't climbed back up into that top pick conversation. Teams have kind of pigeonholed him somewhere, seems now between 7 and 12, something like that.
Yeah, and that surprises me. I mean, he didn't exactly destroy the world out at Utah, but he showed enough upside and I think enough potential to make you think that, it, you know, in 5 years he could be the best of this group. I think a lot of 3-4 teams, even the Eagles at 4, are considering him as a 3-4 end type, but how high do you go with a guy like that? Is he Tyson Jackson part 2? I mean, I'm just saying that, and when those guys go high, they tend to be good players, but not great ones. The guy I don't get is Sharif Floyd. I mean, I saw some explosive ability, watched about 4 games of him this year, but to possibly be mentioned as the number 3 pick in this draft, that to me is stunning. I saw him as a 20 to 30 guy at the end of the season. I saw him as a low first round pick. Now talk him being top 10, maybe even top 5, that surprised me a little bit.
Well, based on all the rankings, Richardson, Williams, Lotulelei, and Floyd going top 10, top 12. Quan Short of Purdue and John Jenkins out of Georgia will almost certainly be first rounders as well. Jonathan Hankins out of Ohio State, Brandon Williams from Missouri Southern. These kids are second round picks. It's a great year to need a defensive tackle. That's going to do it for this week's draft previews, but we got a lot more coming in the next couple weeks. Right now, one more commercial break and then the publisher's pen.
And now with the publisher's pen, the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish.
You know, Eric, I kind of smile every year as we get closer to the NFL draft because I listen to fans around the country, and they're all convinced that even if their team was 4-12 last year, now here comes the draft, we get these picks right, we're going to be a contender right away. It doesn't work that way, folks. You know, if you take a look historically at the NFL college draft, teams that bat 300 to 350 are the teams that eventually become Super Bowl contenders year in and year out. You want to find a couple starters, maybe a couple middle-of-the-roster guys, maybe one surprise, and that's a really good draft. You can afford to miss, but what you cannot afford to miss is when you rarely get one of those top 5 or top 10 picks. Now, the Kansas City Chiefs, Jacksonville Jaguars, Oakland Raiders, and Philadelphia Eagles and Detroit Lions will go 1 through 5, Cleveland at 6, Arizona at 7, Buffalo at 8, the Jets at 9, and the Titans at 10. Those are the picks you cannot miss. And so as you study these scouting reports and realize where the strength is, don't worry about what your team needs. Worry about, will they do what they have to with a top 10 pick? Get a player who becomes a difference maker. That does it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. Our thanks to Randy Meyer, our producer and engineer, and Syndication Networks, our home studio and syndicator. Most of all, our thanks to all of you for listening. Please be sure and join us again next week, same time, same station, for Pro Football Weekly.